Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It's 5 minutes after 5 o'clock. Yes, indeed. I am Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas. Let's take a step back here a second and explain the introduction there. The British accent. Every advertising, or how many different commercials have you heard where there is a spokesperson or whatever with a British accent? And you always know that whatever follows after the British accent is very authoritative, very knowledgeable, and it is meant for you to perk up and pay attention because what follows is the gospel. As a matter of fact, this technique is actually used. Now, you've heard Rush Limbaugh's fill-in, Mark Stein. Does anybody really know truly whether or not he is British, a British subject? I mean, he does have that British accent. Is it fake? Is he trying to make him seem more intelligent than he actually is? Of course, I'm joking, but you kind of get the point. So many different commercials, whether it's Cadillac or whether it's Lexus or AT&T, any of them, various times have used their spokespeople with British accents. So, of course, we've got to start show off and have to let you know that what follows is going to be just very interesting. So here we go. Anyway, again, my name is Kevin Gordon. I have an opinion, and I am not afraid to use it. If you want to know about more, a little bit more about me, head over to my Facebook page, cleverly named Kevin Gordon, and you can find all kinds of good information about me. Yesterday I had a little bit of a glitch, and I was going to post some of the stories that we covered yesterday. I'm going to really delve into that today and really update that tremendously because yesterday was kind of a crazy day. You know, when you start putting together this show, one of the advantages and disadvantages to this is that in the past, I've had, or I still do, have quite a list of people and folks, guests, et cetera, that I have contact information with, and through my activities in Northern Kentucky and around the tri-state area, I have some people that I can rely on to come on the program. And when I'm on, they generally give me a blank slate here. So it's like, go ahead. You've got it open. The downside of that is then I have to line up every one of the guests. And you know that through listening to Brian and listening to the show and whatever, a lot of times I hear a bunch of people that say, well, you know, we need to have a little bit more coverage of Northern Kentucky and that type of thing. And I can tell you from a logistics standpoint, with the tri-state area being as big as it is, and with kind of, if you will, I would say probably in the neighborhood of at least three factions, if you will, you have a lot of the news for the Northern Kentucky area, Campbell County, Boone County, Kenton County, and even down to Grant County, Gallatin County, et cetera, Pendleton. So you've got a lot of the news that are percolating down there, and then, of course, information from downstate with Andy Beshear and Frankfurt and the legislators down there that do affect the northern part, or the northern part of Kentucky, or as we like to say, or some people like to say, the southern part of Cincinnati. Then you have the stories itself that affect the city of Cincinnati, and, of course, with Jeff Pastor and P.G. Sidenfeld and Tamiya Denard. All the shenanigans going on in city council, there's always something percolating there. And then you have the northern suburbs of Cincinnati, the Westchester area, that seems to have their own set of news, et cetera, even Claremont County. And so trying to meld all this together, it is kind of difficult. And when I come on, I try to tailor a lot of the stuff towards Northern Kentucky. I was told at one time that the station has about 60% of its listeners in Northern Kentucky. Now, whether that is still true or not, but again, where you live and where you operate generally is where you get your best news sources or your best contacts, shall we say. I still have a lot of contacts over here, but anyway. So with that said, that's kind of how I've try to put the show together and try to get some of the information from the people and the contacts that I know of. And for some reason, when Joe called me a couple of weeks ago and asked me to fill in, actually he demanded, no, I'm just kidding. He called and said, hey, can you fill in? And I said, yeah, sure. I thought, well, okay, I'm going to kind of wait closer to the time frame, because with everything going on, different news and that type of thing, what was going to be the hot topic around the area and so on. And so I started calling some people last week, and I guess a lot of people took off. A lot of people have been busy, and trying to line people up. I was lining people up as late as 12 o'clock this morning. Which is a little bit past my bedtime if I'm going to be up at 3 o'clock in the morning to come on in here and that type of thing. So anyway, it's interesting. I love it. I love doing it. And don't get me wrong, but it's just very time consuming. And when you're working the phones and that type of stuff, you don't have the time necessarily to update your Facebook page. But by golly, today it looks like I'm going to have plenty of time to do that. Coming up on the program today, to kind of give you a preview, if you hadn't gone to my Facebook page, again, cleverly named Kevin Gordon, we're going to be basically talking news and views between now and 7:30, talking about the topics and some of the headlines. I looked at a couple of headlines before I came on the air just to see what has happened overnight. It's coming at 7 o'clock to 7:30. We're going to be talking to attorney Chris Wiest. And we're going to be discussing his latest lawsuit and motions to intervene, as they are called, filed against Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear in his November 18th restrictions that he has put on the state of Kentucky. And he did have a press conference yesterday that I did listen to a little bit. They covered on the news here overnight. And again, he is sounding the alarm and talking about more restrictions. I hesitate to mention that driving up here, I was listening to a program on the our sister station, and some talk about some of the draconian measures that are being taken in Pennsylvania. I sure hope to hell that the broadcast didn't make its way down to Frankfort, because as we know in Northern Kentucky or in the Kentucky area itself, that if a governor from another state does any kind of a mandate, Andy Beshear treats that as almost like he's in a poker game. I'll see that restriction and I'll raise you this restriction. So, you know, God only knows what restrictions are going to be coming down the pike. And the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to be talking to Covington Mayor Joe Meyer. Joe met him several years ago. And I should mention that Joe runs in different circles than I do. He was or is, well, he's a Democrat. And he was a state senator up until 1996. He has been a part of several of the Democratic governor's cabinet. He was an education secretary and kind of a bubble or two left of center. So normally people that are liberal and whatnot, we don't
step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Kind of rub shoulders together. However, about 3-4 years ago, there was this whole concept, or if you remember back in 2012, there was this whole push to do the public-private partnership, ramrod this through the Kentucky State Legislature, get this bridge started to be built, and do the public-private partnership, and bam, we're going to have tolls. Well, a group of us over in Northern Kentucky, mostly Tea Party people and a lot of different conservatives over there said, no way, no how, no tolls, passed a bunch of resolutions with different cities. Joe, on the other hand, being a person from Covington and a lifelong or mostly Covington resident, saw what the kind of devastation and knew what kind of devastation would come to Covington anytime there's any construction on the bridge. What happens in Covington is absolutely devastating. And should this bridge be built, he realized that the entire western part of Covington was going to be decimated. Main Stross would be a ghost town because of all the diversion, all the traffic, etc. And of course, there are a lot of people that keep asking the question from day one, why in the hell do you have three major arteries going across one bridge? You've got I-71, I-75, and I-74. Three of the most major highways in the region, all bottleneck coming into one area. I'm going to take a quick break, and when I come back, I want to kind of finish the story with Joe Meyer, how we got together, some of the things that our group has put together that has really improved and really moved the ball forward as far as discussions in and about any potential construction of a new bridge over the Ohio River near the Brent Spence. 749-5500, 1-800-823-TALK, 1-800-823-8255, #550, AT&T wireless phone. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. #519 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. I was talking earlier about how I met Joe Meyer, and it's amazing when you get involved in certain issues and certain topics, the people you run into. And Joe and I have talked about this. I mean, the circles we ran in, and I think, I think sometimes Republicans and Democrats tend to, especially on the leadership issue, try to keep the minions, if you will, apart, because the more we can seem like the other side is the enemy, then nothing gets done, and which helps them. But when it comes to certain topics, especially on a local issue, I found out through a mutual friend that Joe and some people that he knew were opposed to the Brent Spence Bridge or the construction of a new bridge there. And so we all kind of got together into a group to have a coordinated effort. Now, when you're talking about state legislators downstate, when you're talking about the Chamber of Commerce, when you're talking about some of these factions, if you will, that keep pushing tolls on the Brent Spence Bridge, when you have a coalition of conservatives, a coalition of Tea Party people, a coalition of liberals, a coalition of just flat-out citizens, concerned citizens, and business owners in a community, a lot can get done. And they have to sit up and take notice. They will, wait, whoa, if these people are together and they're opposing this, we've got a tough nut to crack. And in the course of the conversation, when you start delving into issues, and I don't know on your issue or on your side or things you've been involved in, you get this impression that these people that are in positions of authority, the people that are doing certain things, that they know a lot. And when you start asking questions, as we did with the Brent Spence Bridge, some of the expenses, some of the things they were proposing, you kind of quickly realize that they're really not as bright as you think they are. I can remember being at a meeting, and I was, you know, as I've said, I am a recovering accountant, so numbers mean something to me, and I dig into numbers, and I come up with information, and I say, okay, this doesn't make any sense, etc. I was at a meeting. They were talking about tolls. I brought up a couple of facts. I brought up a couple of issues. I brought up some things that just wasn't making sense. And the current head of the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, I won't mention his name, but he stood up and he goes, well, I appreciate Mr. Gordon's enthusiasm, but he's got his facts wrong. And I said, while I appreciate your information and your input, then you better check your website because that's where I got my information. And so the information that they were talking about in terms of traffic flow and all this sort of stuff. I mean, at one point in one of the meetings, they even pointed out that they didn't even have any exits for Covington if they were going to build a new bridge. In fact, their original plan was to take any traffic going south up to Kyle's Lane, if you're familiar with that area, and then do a U-turn up there and then come back into Covington. Anybody that's ever traveled, you know that once you pass a city, you're not turning around and coming back. And so a lot of the things that we put forth, a lot of the information, as a matter of fact, one of the suggestions that we came up with is now being implemented and will basically add what the equivalent of one more lane of traffic going across that bridge. Because as you're coming north, you got that 12th Street exit, which kind of you're coming down the lane and then all of a sudden you exit off. And then the 4th Street entrance ramp on onto the bridge is actually a lane dedicated across the bridge. Now, by eliminating, and what we suggested, eliminating that 4th Street entrance ramp and what we call the P-flip, if you will, that people coming down 4th Street kind of loop around and go up to 12th Street, come around and enter that way, you've got more of an opportunity to get a little bit of headway on that bridge. And this was suggested by a member of our group, a fellow by the name of Dick Crist, who is in the Kentucky Hall of Fame, Transportation Hall of Fame, because of his ability and because of his engineering skills and his knowledge of how to do things and to build roadways. This was one of the suggestions from our group or in our group that he came up with. And now they're with what has happened with the bridge there, that this is going to spark. They were going to start this construction in the spring, but because of what's going on now with the repairs on the Brent Spence Bridge, they're going to move that time frame up. One of the suggestions we came up with is putting more signage on the bridge. They still haven't implemented that. And we're pushing for that. And out of this group, we also came up with the idea of going back to the drawing board and a proposal that they had back in the 80s to relieve traffic off the Brent Spence Bridge and would, quote, add the most significant economic development in the region, what they were calling a cross-county highway at the time, was expanded to talk about, and you may have heard me talk about, since the Eastern Bypass. And what we saw on the Brent Spence Bridge last week.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
A couple of weeks ago is a classic case in point. But anyway, that's how I got to know Joe. And the interesting thing about that is that we can fight like cats and dogs about every other topic. But where there is a topic that we have an agreement on, and we know what is best, or we talk amongst ourselves as far as what is a good idea for the region. Why not get together with that person? Why not get together with that group of people and put forth alternatives and work towards a common goal? Fight about everything else later on. But for the one issue that you agree on, come together. There's another example I'll get to very shortly here. I'll try to do that, squeeze that in here before we get into the other information on the day. Phone number 749-5500, 1-800-823-TALK, 1-800-823-8255, #550, AT&T wireless phone. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55KRC, the talk station. It's 5:31 in the morning. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55KRC, the talk station. Some local headlines that we're covering for you this morning. I'm seeing reports here and devastating news if you're – well, anyway, it's devastating news for Joe Burrow. It's devastating news for Bengals fans, and it's devastating news for the franchise quarterback, if you will. An MRI showed Burrow tore his ACL and MCL, suffered other structural issues, sources say. Bengals coach Zach Taylor would not confirm the extent of the knee damage, but said that Burrow will be out for the remainder of the 2020 season. I was seeing some reports yesterday that, you know, you remember Carson Palmer experienced what they claimed was similar knee damage and was in a playoff game against the Pittsburgh Steelers. Years ago and was available at the start of the season. But a lot of these injuries generally take anywhere from 9 months to 12 months. And if as much damage as what they're talking about, this could be, I mean, they're talking about possibly a full recovery, but this is not good news. And I hate to see that because although I've had my issues and I'm having my issues with professional sports right now, if you look at Joe Burrow's career, if you look at some of the things that he's done, the type of person he's shown himself to be, he was a bright spot for the Bengals and hopefully was going to be around or hopefully will be around for a long time. But to see something happen like this so early in his career is horrible. Fans show love and support for Joe Burrow after season-ending injury. Football fans are passionate about their favorite teams and player. Now Bengals fans are showing Burrow just how much they already mean to them. More than $27,000 was donated to Joe Burrow's relief fund in the first 24 hours after suffering his injury. The fund is used to help family in needs in the Athens, Ohio community, which is where Burrow is from. The Hunger Relief Fund was established after Burrow's Heisman Trophy acceptance speech. That effort raised more than $650,000 for the Athens County Food Pantry, and now more than $27,000 is pouring in for his hunger relief program. Our son, my wife and I, her son, my stepson, was a chef or had been a chef in Athens, Ohio, working for one of the hotels there, and got to kind of be familiar with the area over there. There is a tremendous amount of poverty in that Athens, Ohio area. It's kind of close to the southeastern portion of the state, and there is an awful lot of poverty there. And Joe Burrow having this hunger relief fund there just shows the quality kind of guy that he is, and recognizing his hometown and helping the people out as a result of his fame and fortune. Officer nearly struck Butler County police chase ends in Hamilton County. Police officer in Butler County was nearly struck by a motorist who then led authorities on a chase that ended in Hamilton County early Tuesday, dispatchers say. One person was taken to Mercy Hospital Fairfield when the pursuit that began in New Miami ended at 2:30 a.m. Shortly after Hamilton County Forest Park. The officer was not hit or hurt, but a parked vehicle was struck at one point, according to dispatchers. Police say a traffic stop when a black Saturn drove too close to an officer. The officers tried to stop the Saturn. That's when the dispatchers took off. I mean, or the police officers took off after him. Never a good, Never a good thing to run away from police officers or to try to get involved in a high-speed chase. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost seeks suspension of Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on in the morning as well. Anyway, it is 5:35 in the morning. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Five 5:39 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Kind of finishing up a story or a comments that I was making before the bottom of the hour about how it's necessary, or not necessary, it's a good idea that if there is a topic that is important to you, that getting together with whomever in order to fight that particular issue is a good thing. And that's how coalitions are put together. That's how those that are opposed to your viewpoint or those who are opposed to the issue that you're interested in sit up and take notice when a group of people that normally aren't together come together for a common goal. Now, I mentioned about the Brent Spence Bridge and the coalition of people that have been put together. Right now, we have a coalition over there of most, with the exception of one, Rhino. I'm not even sure if you'd call him a Rhino. Hell, he might as well just be a Democrat. But most of the Northern Kentucky contingent and our Northern Kentucky caucus, if you will, state representatives, state senators, are all opposed to tolls on the Brent Spence Bridge. Many of them are interested in Cincy Eastern Bypass. One of the topics that came up not too long ago was there was this proposal by some people to move Chase Law School out of Campbell County at Northern Kentucky University and move that into a vacant building in Covington where the old Justice Center was. And they talked about, oh, you know, we can renovate this building. In other words, there was a white elephant there that the city no longer wanted the building. And there were some developers there that thought, oh, what a brilliant idea. We'll just renovate the building. We'll turn it into office space. We'll do the top floor. We'll have kind of a conference center up there. We'll have Chase Law School there in Covington, and then they can have their logo facing Cincinnati, etc. The problem with that being is that all of the professors, all of the law professors, that revenue, that payroll tax, etc., would be coming out of the coffers or be eliminated from the budget of Highland Heights, Kentucky, and Campbell County in particular. Plus the fact that Northern Kentucky University was the salvation, if you will, going back to the history of Chase Law School, back when Chase Law School, originally they had one of their schools or one of their classes, the classrooms, et cetera, near St. Xavier Church in Cincinnati, where, you know, if you're familiar with St. Xavier Church. And then they moved over to Northern Kentucky because there was a campus and some space there. They were in danger of losing their accreditation because they were not affiliated with a university. Of course, UC had their law school, so they weren't interested in Chase Law School. Northern Kentucky University stepped up to the plate and they became part of Northern Kentucky University. And Chase Law School has been on their campus in Northern Kentucky at Northern Kentucky University since. And so it is one of those, a plum asset, an attraction to Northern Kentucky University, and to move that over to Covington would have been bad. A group of us, liberal Democrats, conservative Democrats, Tea Party, conservative Republicans, members of the Board of Regents of Northern Kentucky University got together, formed a committee, and sent a letter to Northern Kentucky University that it's not a good idea to move this. And apparently it worked, because when they realized that there was this pushback from so many different types of people that were willing to come together, they stopped that dead in its tracks. And again, when you are passionate about certain things, I mean, anybody that knows me knows that I look at an issue from all sides. I analyze it. I my first criteria of any issue, is it good for the citizens of that area? Is it good for the region? Does it benefit enough people? And in so many instances, there are too many issues that cities, states, counties get involved in that are only benefiting a few. And when you realize that you're not doing anybody any favor by this, there are other alternatives that need to be looked at. And when you push back, when you show that there is some resistance to that, you can get things done. And it's been a pleasure working with the different groups that I've worked with over the years to get things accomplished. And I'm very proud of that. So anyway, we're coming up on, 5:45, and so we're going to quickly take out a break here real quick. Let me give you the phone numbers in case you want to call in. Phone number 749-5500, 1-800-823-TALK, 1-800-823-8255, #550, AT&T wireless phone. When we get back, I'm going to be talking about a story that was written back in 2000, back when there were reporters. I am amazed when you look back at some of the stories and some of the reporting that was done by reporters back then and the lack of reporting. You know, I don't call reporters, media types, spoon-fed regurgitators for nothing, because they are spoon-fed the information. They do no reporting. They don't do any investigation. They just take talking points, and anymore in the national media, all they do is wait for that 4 o'clock Media Matters email that comes up with the talking points for the day, and that's where they pair it. You've seen Sean Hannity do it. You've seen Rush do it, these montages of where everybody in the mainstream media, every talk show host, every one of the headlines all say the same damn thing. You don't think that's coordinated? It comes from one source. It comes from Media Matters, and it's all coordinated. 5:46 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. #551 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. By the way, I got to give a shout out to my producer this morning, Austin. He's doing an Awesome Austin, I think is what we're going to be calling him. When I'm on, I generally like to have music, bumper music, with it kind of got a little bit of a pep to it, a little bit of, something with a beat to it to kind of, you know, get things started and get things off with a spark. And he's dug up some very good bumper music, so thank you very much for that. I certainly appreciate it. Anyway, I don't have time to get into this story. I'm going to start at the top of the hour, this story that I was talking about. And it's a story that from 2000, as you recall, back in 2000, you had the election, Bush-Gore, and with the Florida recount and so on, people at the time were reflecting back on other close races and other things. And a story that I had never seen before, talking about the 1960 election. I hope your socks are knocked off as much as mine were by this when I read it, but we'll get to that at the top of the hour. I don't have time to really cover that right now. However, I do have, you know, really, in keeping with the tradition of Brian, where the news of the stupid that he does during the 5 o'clock hour, I've got one here. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo cancels his Thanksgiving plan hours after saying his 89-year-old mother and two daughters were coming for dinner. You know, all these restrictions, you know, I've talked about in the past that it's not, it is coming down to where it is not liberal versus conservative, Democrat versus Republican. It is the affected class versus the unaffected class. And there are so many people who think they are above it all. Andrew Cuomo is one of them. If you remember this, I don't know if you saw the stories a couple days ago about Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, where he attended a fundraiser and nobody had a mask on. Originally, he said, "Oh, well, that dinner and that function was outside." Until the report showed that there were pictures of them. I don't know what was going on, but they wound up closing the doors and the festivities continued on inside. It's okay for us to forego our Thanksgiving. It's okay for us to mask up, but not the people in charge. Not leading by example. They're great to tell you what to do, but when it comes to them, mm-mm-mm. Governor Andrew Cuomo, who ought to be indicted for the murder of the people in the nursing homes, taking people who had COVID and putting them back in the nursing homes, even though everybody knew at the time that COVID-19 was targeting elderly people and that anybody with underlying conditions, they were very susceptible to dying. Thousands and thousands of New Yorkers have died. And in fact, I saw a report the other day where they are ginning, or they're fudging the numbers, if you will, because when they pick up a body at a nursing home, they're not declaring that person dead. They're taking them to the hospital and pronouncing them dead. That way, you don't have to report that the death occurred in a nursing home. But anyway, quickly before we get to the break, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo will not be having Thanksgiving. His 89-year-old mother and two of his three daughters. The story is my mom going to come up and two of the girls, but the plans change. However, later Monday, senior advisor Cuomo said the insider, the dinner will be off. The internet was quick to drag Cuomo, given that he's been urging New Yorkers to stay home and limit travel this Thanksgiving. Just such hypocrisy from him. I mean, talk about a person that I would love. I mean, he said that he wants to punch the president. Well, you know what? I guess it's okay for me to start listing some of the people that I'd like to punch, and he's top of the
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The list. And his puke brother, Fredo, is at the other, is also on the list. 5:55 in the morning. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas. 55 KRC, the talk station. It's 5 minutes after 6 o'clock. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. I have an opinion, and I'm not afraid to use it. Find out more about me by heading over to my Facebook page, Kevin Gordon, cleverly named Facebook page, Kevin Gordon. You can also go to SoundCloud. I've got some podcasts up there that I have done. I also have a YouTube channel, Kevin Gordon Radio. There's some podcasts up there. Today, later on today, I'm going to be posting the podcast from here today and possibly yesterday. Like I said, yesterday was kind of a blur and a lot of things going on, so I didn't have a chance to upload the podcast from yesterday to the to my website or to my Facebook page or to my SoundCloud account. But I will do that today as well. Today, I've got a blank slate after the show is over, so I'm looking forward to doing that and getting a lot of things done and, again, show prep for tomorrow. So anyway, coming up, I want to give you a kind of a heads up in terms of what we got planned for you today. Coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, an hour from now, we're going to be talking to attorney Chris Wiest. And we'll be discussing his latest lawsuit and motion to intervene. It's called a motion to intervene with Governor Andy Beshear and his latest edicts, November 18th restrictions that he's put in place. 8 o'clock, we're going to be talking to Covington Mayor Joe Meyer. He'll be talking about the Brent Spence Bridge closure and the resulting traffic diversions that they are experiencing there in Covington, and kind of, if you will, a taste of what might happen to Covington when and if, or hopefully never, a new bridge is built there. Because, again, there's certain things that can be done, and in retrospect, I don't want to get into that and tip the hat and all that sort of stuff. We'll talk about that more in the 8 o'clock hour. Give you kind of a preview of tomorrow as well. At 7 o'clock hour, I've got Kurt Hartman. You may remember he was a he's an attorney. Brian had him on, I believe, last week, talking about the people's lawsuit that they filed, or that he filed, against Jeff Pastor to have him removed. And he's preparing another one for P.G. Sidenfeld, and he'll be bringing us up to date on that. And at 8 o'clock, we're going to be talking to Congressman Thomas Massey. It'll be the first time I've had an opportunity to talk to him since Election Day. We'll talk about, obviously, his work on the Transportation Committee, one of the committees that he's on in Congress. Of course, the topic of the Brent Spence Bridge will come up, also voter fraud and vaccine. He is an MIT engineer, so he is scientifically oriented, and he has some very interesting insights into some of the things. And again, I'm going to have an opportunity, I hope, to talk about some of these vaccines just as kind of a preview, if you will. I won't get to it on the program, but I would encourage you to look up online. They call it the great vaccine debate, but basically it was a discussion between Alan Dershowitz and Robert Kennedy Jr. Printing this thing off is about 25, 26 pages of text, a transcript, etc. Again, it's one of those things of where you kind of know certain information about vaccines, certain information about, you know, just your gut reaction on things. And I normally don't have a whole lot of interest, if you will, or faith in anything that comes out of the Kennedy family. And I've never really liked Robert Kennedy Jr., but I will tell you, he made me sit up and take notice with some of the things that he said in this conversation. It's a very long, it's well worth your trouble to pull that podcast up and listen to it. You know, you can put it, you know, set it there. There's really no, one of the things about it is that there's not like there's any charts. There are some charts and graphs that you might want to look at while they're talking, but for the most part, it's information. So you can be doing other things and listening to this as you're doing other things. A lot of great information in that interview. So anyway, that's what we've got coming up. Story I want to get to. I mentioned to you that it's interesting when you delve back into what journalism used to be and how they used to dig into stories and actually did reporting other than being spoon-fed regurgitators. With what's going on as far as, and nobody is going to convince me otherwise, that there wasn't amounts of voter fraud. I don't, you know, Rob Portman, shut up, okay? Just shut up. You have been on the wrong side of so many issues. I just wish you just, you know, pay attention to the fact that you're a Republican. Pay attention to the fact that you claim to be a conservative. And pick which team you're on. Anyway, it may seem that Rob Portman's calling on Trump to concede and all this sort of stuff. All right. Back in 2000, as you may recall, there was a close race. The race was too close to call. The back and forth with the Florida being called for Gore at one point. Then the networks had to pull that back, and they eventually awarded it to Bush. Al Gore made a concession speech or called Bush on the phone and conceded. And then about a half hour, 45 minutes later, called back and rescinded that. And then which launched into 37 days of a delay of calling that election because the Democrats were suing in different Democrat counties claiming that they wanted all votes to count. But really what they wanted were just votes recounted and mined, find more Democrat votes in Democratic counties in order to propel Gore into victory. 37 days. You don't hear that from the spoon-fed regurgitators in the mainstream media. You don't hear them talking about back at the time as, oh, you know, Gore is just, you know, exercising his constitutional right. We got to get this election right because we don't want anybody disenfranchised. Well, every vote must count, blah, 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 blah. That's all the mantra was. But the bottom line was all they wanted was Democrat votes, more Democrat votes counted. They didn't care about doing any recanvassing in Republican counties, which would have probably found more votes for Bush and increased the margin of victory. But at the time, news reporters were putting out stories about other elections. And in some of my research over the last couple of weeks, I've looked at, there is a story that I hopefully get to later on today, if I can. If not, I'll get it to it tomorrow. The five most rigged elections in U.S. history. Rigged elections. To listen to the spoon-fed regurgitators in the mainstream media, they will tell you that, oh, there's never been any case of voter fraud. There's no instances. There's no proof. There's none of this. A news blackout. Total news blackout. Any information that goes against their narrative, they're blacking it out. They're blocking it on Twitter. They're blocking it on Facebook. Just like they're blocking any information about possible, I mean, look what they did to hydroxychloroquine. Look what they've done to Remdesivir, the possible drugs, because these are cheap, available drugs. They're not going to be the hybrid drugs that somebody has a patent like Dr. Fauci on to where he can make millions of dollars from a cure or a vaccine. Instead, this would be available to the American public at a reasonable price and get us over this hump. But instead, what we want to do is prolong this COVID-19. Anyway. The title of this story is Another Race to the Finish. It was written November the 17th, 2000. The story is about the 1960 election and some things in there that I didn't realize had happened. They start off, the president was smart, and the vice president was smart and savvy, but stiff. You know, of course, Kennedy was this handsome guy, blah, blah, blah. The race was too close to call. The Republican Party sent operatives to disputed states to search for ways to overturn the official tally. Nasty court battles dragged on for weeks. It goes into the story of what happened on that election night. The Ambassador Hotel around 5 o'clock, that would be California time, so 8 o'clock in the eastern part. Nixon turned on the television. He was already behind. An hour later, with only 8% of the vote in, the polls still open in the West, CBS predicted a Kennedy victory. All the computing machines, explained CBS's Eric Severide, are now saying Kennedy. Nixon's campaign people said we ought to take all those electronic computers and throw them in a junk pile. And he warned the networks that this is coming down to the wire. And once again, surprise, surprise, the networks ignored the information from Leonard Hall, Nixon's campaign manager. The networks ignored Hall and listened to their computers. NBC predicted a landslide for Kennedy, and when the race got tighter, the networks began backtracking. It called Ohio for Kentucky, or I'm sorry, called Ohio for Kennedy, then awarded it to Nixon. Later on, NBC and CBS predicted Kennedy victory in California. That too proved wrong and ultimately went to Nixon. I'll continue with the story when we get back. 6:16 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas. It gets better from here. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Six 20 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Boy, how appropriate. Dirty Laundry. Wow. Yeah, that is one of the classics. Let's get to the phones real quick. I want to get to Pat here before I continue on with my narrative on the 1960 election, which, interestingly enough, there are a tremendous amount of parallels between then and now. You wouldn't think so, but there are. Pat, 55 KRC, thanks for calling. How are you?
Good morning, Gordon. How are you?
I am doing just fine.
It's been a while.
It has.
Yeah,
it has.
Yeah. Well, I'm calling today because I was listening to you. I just turned you on, and you were talking about, I guess, the Kennedy election.
Yes.
And there are similarities, I think, between what happened then and what's going on now with President Donald Trump. Me personally, I thought this election, there was a fraud, irregardless of what Rob Portman, who is one of our congressmen for Ohio, is saying.
Yes. Senator from Ohio.
And it's very disappointing because we all went to school. We all have an education. We all saw the election. Mm-hmm. You had one candidate that was in their basement, Joe Biden. You had another candidate like President Donald Trump who was not only campaigning for himself, but I felt like he was campaigning for the country, mm-hmm. trying to make America great again. And you have Joe Biden, who is going to be going more globalist, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
And
you know, this election just does not pass the smell test. And I've got some statistics that I want to talk about later on, but I kind of give you a little bit of a preview here. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions here. Do you believe that 25 million more people voted in this election than in 2016? 25 million more?
I believe it was probably more than that. That's why they halted the numbers. I was watching that night,
yeah.
And Ohio was called, I guess about 12 midnight,
yeah.
Which actually the numbers were in for Ohio, I think, before then, but the networks held up.
Yeah, because they wanted Biden continually ahead. They did not want Trump to appear as though that he was going to victory. Another question for you. Do you think that Biden received 10 million more votes than Barack Obama back in 2008?
Absolutely not.
Do you think that Biden received 14 million more votes than Hillary did four years ago?
No, yes. Way. Hillary lost, and she had campaigned. So if Biden was in his basement, no. But I will tell you something about Joe Biden. What helped Joe Biden was that he went around to the African-American churches, and they helped him. And by the way, this was Reverend Sharpton talking, not me.
Mm-hmm.
And he was basically saying that that they had helped Biden, and they're expecting something.
Of course they are.
And so is Black Lives Matter. Black
Absolutely.
Black Lives Matter is
so is Antifa.
Something. Yes.
So are the globalists.
Yes.
Pat, thank you very much. I certainly
no
appreciate
problem.
It. Have a great day. Okay, back to my story here because I'm going to probably go a little late for this break. But before midnight, again, we're talking about the 1960 election and parallels till today. Before midnight, back east, the New York Times went to press with a banner headline: "Kennedy elected president." But Nixon kept gaining ground, and soon the race was too close to call. Times managing editor Turner Catledge, fearful that he was being embarrassed by his headline, began to hope. He later recalled in his memoirs that he hoped a certain Midwestern mayor would steal enough votes to pull Kennedy through. He was referring, of course, to Mayor Richard J. Daley, a very powerful party boss in Illinois, so powerful he could make the dead vote. But an election night dragged on. Nixon took the lead in Illinois. The news was stunning to Sergeant Shriver. You may remember he was a brother-in-law of Kennedy, married to his sister. Maria Shriver's father. He was the campaign manager for Illinois and was really upset what he was seeing. He sneaked out of the room and said, I couldn't face those people. He was kind of hiding in his room, almost crying. Suddenly, somebody was rapping at the door and said, Sarge, the votes in Illinois have changed. Shriver rushed back to the TV room, and it was true. A late surge of votes from Chicago had put Kennedy back in the lead in Illinois. Nixon and his aides were watching the same returns. We were getting good reports out of Illinois, but we noticed that a lot of precincts in Chicago weren't reporting. Sound familiar? Then they reported en masse.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And there was little, and that was a little suspicious. By midnight, 3 o'clock in the east, Kennedy had a lead. Nixon went upstairs. He talked to some of his aides. He went back upstairs and continued to look at some of the results. Kennedy's lead in the popular vote was melting away from 800,000 votes to 600,000 votes to fewer than a half a million vote. Nixon took Washington and Oregon. Illinois was still too close to call. So were California and Minnesota. Nixon eventually won all of them. I'm sorry, if Nixon won all of them, he did win California that year. When he fell asleep shortly after 4 o'clock, Nixon still didn't know. That means 4 o'clock out west. That means 7 o'clock in the morning in the east. They were still counting votes. They didn't stop at 10:30 at night. They didn't stop 3 hours into the voting. They didn't vote counting. They didn't stop and hold the because apparently, and nobody is going to convince me otherwise, that the returns were coming in so overwhelmingly for Trump that they didn't know what the hell to do, and they had to come up with an alternative plan in order to swing this election, this fraudulent election, to Joe Biden. When we get back at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to continue with the story because it just gets juicier from here. 6:27 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station.6:31 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Continuing this story called Another Race to the Finish. It is an excellent story written back in November of 2000 by Peter Carlson of the Washington Post, of all things, talking about the 1960 election. It was one of the closest elections. When Nixon woke up a couple hours later, he went to bed at 4 o'clock California time, which means 7 o'clock in the east. Again, overnight, voting continued. The race still hadn't been called by 7 o'clock in the morning. 2 hours later, 2 hours later, by about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the morning, they had called the race in Kennedy's favor. It was one of the closest elections on record. Out of 68 million votes, the difference between the parties was only 113,000 votes. Nixon would have won if he had taken Texas, where he lost by only 46,000 votes, and Illinois, where he lost by fewer than 9,000. Both of those states are very important. As you recall, Kennedy's vice president was Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was notorious for fixing elections and voter fraud in Texas. As a matter of fact, it was years later that it was discovered that he, in fact, had stolen an election down there that led to him getting into the Senate, which then launched his career in the Senate, which then propelled him onto the ticket with Jack Kennedy in 1960, and later, after the assassination, actually became president. So crime does pay for the Democrats. You steal an election, you can wind up being president. Does that sound familiar? Anyway, Nixon called President Eisenhower. As you recall, Nixon was Eisenhower's vice president at the time. Ike told him that he had heard rumors of voter fraud in Texas and Illinois and urged him to check it out. His campaign manager, the people, were talking to him about fighting on, doing the investigation, looking into this. They talked about Nixon being exhausted. He had been campaigning. He just didn't seem like he had the belly for doing this. In fact, he said that he didn't want to put the country through a constitutional crisis. Well, hell, what is a constitutional crisis? If somebody steals an election, that is a constitutional crisis. Standing up for your rights and standing up for the people that voted for you is not a constitutional crisis. It's the thing to do. Republicans were hollering about voter fraud. Senator Everett Dirksen, you may recall, Senator Everett Dirksen is the person, the Republican, that was able to get more votes, more Republicans to vote percentage-wise in the Senate for the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. He was screaming that in his home state of Illinois, there seemed to be some voter fraud. Barry Goldwater in Arizona. Again, sound familiar? Arizona now seems to have had some fraud out there. Was echoing Dirksen's concerns about Chicago and saying the rottenest election machinery in the United States. Leonard Hall, the campaign manager, and Kentucky Senator Thurston Moorton, head of the Republican National Committee, flew to Key Biscayne, Florida the next day while because Nixon had left Washington and went down to Florida, trying to urge him to fight on. He thought that the contest would do great harm to the country if they would have fought this. Hall and Mortensen, or Moorton rather, dispatched teams of GOP operatives to ferret out fraud in Illinois, New Jersey, Texas, Missouri, New Mexico, Nevada, South Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Do any of these states sound familiar to you of what some of the shenanigans going on now? Illinois, New Jersey, Texas, Missouri, New Mexico, Nevada, Pennsylvania. They failed to uncover much fraud in most of those states, but they hit pay dirt in Texas and Illinois. Wait till you hear what happened in those states. 6:36 in the morning. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Coming up on 6:41 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Continuing this story, another race to the finish, a story from Peter Carlson back in November of 2000, talking about the 1960 election, Kennedy versus Nixon, and an awful lot of parallels from what we were seeing back then to now. I'd encourage you to look up the story. I will be posting it on my Facebook page later on. But it shows how the networks originally kind of bring you up to speed. The networks were right from the start saying all their computer models were saying that it was going to be a landslide victory for Kennedy. Turned out to be one of the closest election of all time. And based on what we know now and some of the information we know, was a stolen election by the Democrats. So don't tell me that they haven't perfected their technique from 1960 to 2020. Okay. In Texas, like I said, they were the Republican National Committee. They were hearing rumors of voter fraud in various different states. They hit pay dirt in Texas and Illinois. In Texas, Kennedy's 46,000 vote margin was the closest statewide race there since 1948, when Kennedy's running mate, Lyndon Johnson, won a Senate seat by 87 votes. That's when they started nicknaming him Landslide Lyndon as kind of a tongue-in-cheek. He stole that election, as I mentioned in the previous segment, stole that election, which led him into becoming a senator and then eventually Kennedy's running mate. For instance, in Fannin County, which had 4,895 registered voters, 6,138 votes were cast. 1,300 more votes were cast in that county than registered voters. Surprisingly enough, three-quarters of them went to Kennedy. In one precinct in Angelia County, 86 people voted, but the final tally was 147 for Kennedy and 24 for Nixon. That's 170-some votes where only 86 people had voted in that county. But there was no recount. The Texas Board of Election, composed entirely of Democrats, had already certified Kennedy as the winner. Surprisingly enough, Republicans demanded a recount. John Connally, the state Democratic chairman, said Republicans were just haggling for headlines. John Connally, you may remember, was eventually the governor of Texas and was sitting in the front seat the day that Kennedy was assassinated, and he was hit by one of the bullets. In Chicago, where Kennedy won more than 450,000 votes, local reporters uncovered so many stories of electoral shenanigans, including voting by the dead, that the Chicago Tribune concluded that, quote, "The election of November 8th was characterized by such gross and palpable fraud." Palpable means obvious to anybody that sees it. "Characterized by such gross and palpable fraud as to justify the conclusion that Nixon was deprived of victory." Republican National Committee filed suit to challenge the Chicago results. The case was assigned to Circuit Court Judge Thomas Kluczynski, a Daley, Richard Daley appointee, and not an appointee, but part of the Daley machine. On December 13th, Kluczynski dismissed the Republican suits. Less than a year later, on Daley's recommendation, Kennedy appointed Kluczynski to the federal bench. Nothing shady going on there. Nothing to see here. Just move along. Ultimately, a special prosecutor, Morris Wexler, was appointed to investigate the Chicago fraud allegation. Wexler brought charges against 650 election officials, but Democratic judges' pro-defense rulings crippled his case. Finally, in 1962, 2 years later, after an election judge, confessed to witnessing vote tampering in Chicago's 28th Ward, three precinct workers were jailed. An American journalist, okay, Earl Mazzo, who at the time worked for the New York Herald. When this story was written back in 2000, he was 81 years old and was recalling what he observed and what he learned as a result of his investigation. Earl Mazzo, writing for the New York Herald Tribune. We will get to that right after the break. 6:46 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Coming up on 6:50 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Wrapping up this story, another race to the finish, Washington Post story from November 2000 by Peter Carlson talking about the 1960 election. Again, to reset the table, the networks were all calling for early on that this was going to be a landslide on the part of Kennedy. Became one of the closest elections in American history prior to 2000, the Bush-Gore race. The head-to-head contest there. And as we know, and as people know today, that election was stolen from Nixon. And again, finishing up this story, this reporter, Earl Mazzo, who was with the New York Herald Tribune at the time, in 2000, he was 81 years old and was talking to this reporter. He said he kept getting these phone calls that you got to come. You're missing the biggest story of the century. You got to come to Chicago and you've got to investigate this. So He headed to Chicago and obtained a list of voters and precincts that seemed suspicious in some of these precincts and some of these. So he went to the actual voter polls or voter rolls and looked up some of the numbers. There was a cemetery where the names on the tombstones were registered and voted. I remember a house. It was completely gutted. There was nobody there. Nobody living there. The house was gutted. But 56 votes for Kennedy came out of that home. After investigating Illinois, Mazzo headed to Texas, where he documented similar electoral shenanigans. With visions of a Pulitzer Prize dancing in his head, Mazzo began writing what he and editors envisioned, a 12-part series on election fraud. By mid-December, he had published four parts of the series. He got a phone call from Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon met with him and asked him not to continue writing the stories or publishing the stories. Mazzo said this was a huge story. And Nixon said that, you know, he didn't want to have a constitutional crisis at the height of the Cold War, which I think is a bunch of crap on Nixon's part. Mazzo refused. Nixon contacted the paper. The paper killed the story. The other eight parts of the story never got out. Now, why in the hell would Nixon, again, if you're talking about a constitutional crisis, isn't a constitutional crisis, for God's sake, the fact that your voters, the people of the country, voted for you to become president and the election was stolen and you don't want that disclosed? What does that say about you as a candidate? Don't you get into a race because you think your ideas are better than the other guy? Don't you think that you're a better candidate, that you would be a better president than that person? Why would you succumb to a situation where you know that there was voter fraud? And look at the events that followed. We have Kennedy. We have Johnson as vice president. You have the Kennedy assassination 3 years later in Dallas. You have then you have Lyndon Johnson, who became president, who escalated beyond control and got us into the Vietnam quagmire. Would there have been a different outcome there? Nixon was an anti-communist. He was, in fact, he cut his teeth on fighting communism in the United States. And, of course, at the time, you had a lot of your people who said, oh, you know, communism, kind of like they say with Antifa now, oh, it's just a philosophy. It's you know, it will never fly here. It's not a popular concept. The communists are nobody to fear. Yeah, right. Okay. So we get in the quagmire in Vietnam. And then I wonder if because of the paranoia that Nixon had as a result of this election and the mental state, if when he ran for president in 1968 and eventually won, one of the stories they talk about was when Bobby Kennedy entered the race in March of 1968, believe it or not, the same year as the election. I mean, you know, most of these elections now, people start 2 years out. He actually entered the race in March of 1968, and Nixon was fearful that Bobby Kennedy, yet another Kennedy, was going to steal an election from him. I mean, we know that Bobby Kennedy wound up being assassinated. He went up against Hubert Humphrey, won, and then 4 years later was running against McGovern. And again, worried about the election, whether or not he'd be reelected. It led to the whole Watergate thing. And then the final analysis of that election, he wound up winning that election 1972. He won that election by 60% of the vote. So they didn't even need the break-in in Watergate. I mean, talk about stupidity. Talk about unforced errors. Talk about something that should never.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18-plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Never have happened. Again, because of a stolen election in 1960, the outcome of history was altered forever. 6:55 in the morning. When we get back, we're going to be talking to Chris Wiest about latest lawsuits that he filed against Governor Beshear in Kentucky. I am Kevin Gordon, filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Five minutes after 7 o'clock, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. I have an opinion, and I'm not afraid to use it. Find out more about me by heading over to my Facebook page, cleverly named Kevin Gordon. And you can also check out some podcasts that I have up on YouTube, Kevin Gordon Radio, or head over to my SoundCloud account and look at some of the podcasts I have there. Today I'm going to be uploading the show from yesterday as well as the show from today. And I'll have that up there and on my Facebook page later on today, as well as some of the stories that we are going to be talking about. And as I mentioned when we previewed the show, my guest this hour is attorney Chris Wiest. Chris, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah. For a lot of people that don't know, Chris Wiest has been very active over in Northern Kentucky, standing up for the rights of private citizens against quasi-intergovernmental agencies, such as Sanitation District Number 1 and other things. And shockingly, I guess, that one of the only attorney that I'm aware of, other than occasionally our attorney general, that is actually pushing back against Andy Beshear and his dictatorial mandates that have been coming down since March. Am I missing something there?
You're mostly not. I do have two co-counsel that do these cases with me.
But together, you guys here, we're not talking about attorneys down in Bowling Green, attorneys down in Frankfurt, attorneys in Louisville, Lexington, et cetera. It's just shocking to me that so many people are sitting on their hands and saying, oh, okay, governor says so, we'll do it.
But anyway, I agree. All right. Yeah, I agree.
Okay. The latest, we had a horrible ruling from the Kentucky State Supreme Court, which when we think about whether or not these people really are smart, when you read the opinion and some of the stuff that I've read, and I'm not an attorney, but some of their gyrations, some of their mental gymnastics just aren't very smart. You filed a motion to intervene on the part of the federal and also a appeals court. So bring us up to date on where we are, basically. I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, and
counselor,
you know, we started this, Kevin. I'm sure you remember, in federal court.
Yes,
and there was a reason I started this in federal court. And you know, we filed, I think I'm up to three or four lawsuits now in federal court on. And we've won every single one of those. We reopened in-person worship in the spring. We struck down his travel ban in the spring. We struck down his gathering ban on political gatherings in the kind of late spring, early summer. I filed a lawsuit for landlords, and then that kind of, you know, that kind of got, you know, waylaid a little bit with the CDC order. And then yeah, we filed the state case because we felt like the most protections for economic rights for businesses would be in state court. You know, we were a little skeptical about the Kentucky Supreme Court. We kind of knew what we were getting going in. They did what they did, and I think you're right with mental gymnastics. I would say that what they did was overruled essentially, or failed to follow 50 years of case law to reach the result that they thought was their right result. And now, if I'm not mistaken,
they basically hinge their decision on what is it, KRS 39A, which basically seems to indicate that In the case of an emergency, the governor can do damn near anything he wants to do. He can suspend the Constitution. He can suspend KRS regulations, which is Kentucky Revised Statute, mandates, any kind of rules, regulations, et cetera, and basically operate as a total dictator, which when in the final analysis, I guess the argument would be to the Supreme Court, well, then you have no standing to even rule here because he basically says the Constitution in the state of Kentucky doesn't exist. You were formed by the Constitution of Kentucky, so thank you very much. You're not a player in this, which they have to be. But then they come up and basically say, well, you know, it's for the good of the people. It's, you know, the intention of the lawmakers, which I always, you know, I always thought that judges ruled on the letter of the law. They didn't go and do what I call necrotelepathy, where they try to interpret and read the brainwaves of dead people and say, well, they must have intended this at the time. Am I missing something?
You know, Kevin, it's even worse than that.
The legislature,
the legislature put a check and a balance into the use of these emergency powers. And what the legislature said was before the governor could act kind of statewide or even in any county, he had to get local determinations that, whatever the issue was beyond the capability of the local agency. There was a preference written into the statute, plain language, that said, you know, you got to go and get the locals to decide that they can't handle it first. Well, the governor and Dr. Stack admitted that never happened. And the Kentucky Supreme Court, in their wisdom, said, well, it just wasn't really practical to follow that here. We're going to kind of ignore what the people's elected representatives said about when the governor can do this because, man, you know, we just really want him to have these powers. And you know, what they did is really a fundamental assault on democracy. It's a fundamental assault on the rule of law to rule for him. And, you know, it is offensive. I think a lot of members of the legislature were highly offended at that. I think rightly so. So, you know, I mean, I view that decision as a travesty in judicial activism.
I may be mistaken on this. I think that originally some of the state legislators, and especially back in March when Savannah Maddox put forth that bill, 130, that tried to limit the governor because he was already trying to institute mandates. And I think there was not a whole lot of appetite on the part of the state legislators. And I kind of want to cut them some slack, but I don't, because there was this big unknown. You don't want to be on the wrong side of a tragedy and do something that's going to hamper the ability to solve problems. But I don't think they even thought that the governor would go as far as he's gone. And I think when you see some of the travesties and some of the things that have happened around the state since then, I think these legislators are finally waking up and saying, what the hell did we do? Maybe we need to start jumping on board and reining this in.
I think you're spot on. Savannah, you know, it was getting near the end of the session when he started doing these emergency orders, and I think Savannah recognized the real problems that could come down the road with any one guy legislating with the stroke of a pen, mm-hmm. Essentially criminalizing, you know, everyday conduct, small businesses, et cetera. And she did. I mean, she tried to, it was too late for new bills. She put an amendment on one of her existing bills that she was the sponsor of to limit his powers, and the leadership in the Kentucky House of Representatives killed it because their view was, well, it's early, it's COVID, it's dangerous. We want to give the governor, you know, the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, and in so doing, I mean, we've had this 9-month reign of terror as a result of that. And I do credit Savannah, you know, for trying to stop this ahead of time. This giant toll of human misery that has been caused by the governor. I mean, when you look at the unemployment numbers, when you look at, we had an expert come in the state court case. It was $2.8 billion economic impact in July. It's worse today. There's just a laundry list. So that kind of gets us to last week. And the restrictions he put on last week, as you know, which, you know, he banned all schools again, closed all schools. I have an opinion about why he did all schools. And, you know, since this is an opinion show, I'll share it. everybody knows that the governor is beholden to the KEA, the teachers union.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And everybody knows that the teachers union, you know, if push comes to shove, if they have an excuse not to be at work, you know, generally they have taken advantage of that, whether it's to go to the Capitol to protest Governor Bevin or whatever it is. So they don't want to go to work.
See, protests were okay back then because it was their protest. It's only when it's our protest that they're wrong. And
Well, and you know, by the way, Kevin, that is one of the issues we've got in our protest case. The governor has it up on appeal in the Sixth Circuit. We have an injunction against him banning protests. But to be clear, the only protests that he didn't like and that he, you know, criminalized and kind of sent the state, well, sent the state police after him, blocking roads and everything else, were the ones that protested him. Because if you were there for the Black Lives Matter protest, you know, he was out to greet you and speak with you and speak the protest. And
without a mask on. Maskless.
Yeah, we call that viewpoint discrimination in what I do, and it's highly, highly unconstitutional. So
I'm sorry. I pulled you away from where we were heading. I'll tell you
what. Yeah, you did.
Sorry. Hold that thought. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, I will shut up and quit interrupting you. As my wife says, when I'm talking, sometimes I interrupt myself. She'll call me and she'll say, you know, you're in the middle of a rant, and then all of a sudden you go diverted off. Quit interrupting yourself. So I'm going to not interrupt you when we get back, okay? My guest is Chris Wiest, one of the, a hero to the common man in the state of Kentucky, standing up for the rights of Kentuckians against this dictatorial governor. Chris, we'll be right back. I am Kevin Gordon, filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. It is 7:20 in the morning. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Continuing our conversation with Chris Wiest. As I said before, one of the only, he and his associates, the only attorneys that are standing up to this dictator that we have in Andy Beshear downstate. Of all the attorneys in all the counties, all the cities, Lexington, Louisville, Frankfort, et cetera, one person and a couple of people in this area. There must be something in the water here that liberty-minded people speak up and actually take action between Thomas Massie, Jim Jordan. Must be something in the Ohio Valley. Welcome back to the program, Chris. Thank you for hanging on with us. So getting back to the gist of these lawsuits and where we stand and what is going on and what's percolating out there.
So we were just talking about, I think, the, you know, why he banned all schools last week. And, we mentioned the KEA, the teachers union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think cases were on the rise of the community. You know, it was by the way, there has not been community spread in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the CDC's put out statements, even, you know, the East Coast mayors. I mean, you know, if Mario Cuomo is out there saying, look, we're not really seeing this stuff being spread in schools, it's a pretty good indication probably it's not being spread through the schools. It doesn't mean the kids that have a COVID case here or there aren't coming to school, you know, because they've gotten it in the community, but it's not being spread in schools. So we know it's not being, you know, we know that the evidence is there. The CDC's made statements about it.
And so, I know I promised I wouldn't interrupt you, but he banned schools, but not daycares, not YMCA, not other gatherings,
et cetera. And that gets to the heart of the lawsuit. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So,
okay.
So the KEA, they don't want to go to school. And they go to the governor, who they help put in office, and they say, you know, we don't want to go to school. Cases are up. You know, we don't want to go to school. The governor says, okay, well, I'll do you a solid. I'll ban school. And then they get to thinking of, you know, public school. And then they get to thinking about it, and they're like, well, but a public school is banned and the private schools are still allowed to go, then we're going to look really bad, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, what do we do about that? I mean, we can't be looking bad, like we don't want to go to work and, you know, and whatnot. So I think what happened then is, you know,
we're not essential workers like grocery store clerks.
Well, I am highly respectful of teachers as a profession, but the teachers union, I think, in Kentucky, the KEA, is – and there's another teachers union that's not this way, and I have the utmost respect for them. I think that they really are abusive, and I think we've seen some of that abuse come out front and center with some of the stuff this governor's done. as sort of political payback favors. But you know, so they ban all school, and then they ban public and private school. And when we litigated in the fall the Roberts and Maryville cases, we established in the Sixth Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals for Ohio, Kentucky, Michigan, and Tennessee. It's the four states. Mm-hmm. The notion about religious discrimination and the exceptions and what you look at. And you just hit the nail on the head. So what you look for are discrimination. And then on the face of it, the governor would say, and did say in federal court, well, I banned all schools, so it's neutral, and so therefore, you know, I win. And if it were really neutral, he would win. But you just brought up the point. And the comparators are, we've got kids sitting in an NTI classroom at the YMCA getting one-on-one tutoring, just like they would in school, eating lunch, just like they would in normal school, at YMCAs and daycare centers around the state. And by the way, I'm not criticizing those centers for doing this. I think it's a safe activity for these kids to be spread out in a socially distanced manner, mm-hmm. you know, learning. But they're able to do that.
And colleges and universities are still open.
And colleges and universities, and you know, and pre-K daycare, and you know, some of these private schools have daycare in the same facility for pre-K, and they're allowed to, you know, have those kids in. And when you look at it and you dig a little deeper, which is what I believe the case law requires, to dig a little deeper and look at that as the comparator, you know, I think it is discriminatory, you know, that he is banning this practice of particularly, you know, really in the parochial schools, because there the practice of faith is part and parcel with the school curriculum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if that's the case, you know, and you've got a sincerely held religious belief that's being exercised, it can't be discriminatory, and it is here because of the YMCAs and the limited duration centers and the regular daycare centers. They're allowed to operate. So that's the federal claim. Actually, there's a couple of federal claims. The other thing he did last week was you cannot have more than two households or more than eight people in a single house for a gathering. So, you know, we found some folks with families of nine, and we just don't think that the governor can constitutionally require parents to have one of the kids sleep outside. And, you know,
it's bad enough that most of us husbands sleep on the couch, but that's a story for another day.
Well, and this isn't his first rodeo, right? Like, one of the only thing that Kentucky Supreme Court found that he did that was unconstitutional in their eyes was when they, you know, when they banned event centers from having.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Kids, you know, sit next to their parents. They had mm-hmm. everybody having to sit 6 feet apart. And as applied to families, even the Kentucky Supreme Court found that was unconstitutional. So I look at that and I think that there is, you know, an appetite to strike down, you know, at least in the federal court system where we filed it, you know, those restrictions. And so we tried to, you know, there was a lawsuit the Attorney General and Danville Christian brought late last Friday. We were already in process with eight schools and a bunch of parents and everything else when they brought that case, and we tried to intervene over the weekend. And there was an injunction hearing on it yesterday, rather than being let in, the governor's office wanted to go play games. They said that, you know, that they wanted some time to think about whether or not they were going to oppose our motion to intervene. And so I'm like, you know what? The other case has already been argued. And I told them ahead of time I was going to do this. I said, if you guys oppose or in any way, you know, mess with my intervention, I'm just going to go and turn around and file a new lawsuit. I'm going to do it in Northern Kentucky. So this morning – we are filing a new lawsuit against the governor. We're gonna withdraw, you know, kind of trying to get into the Attorney General's lawsuit. We're gonna file a new lawsuit up in Northern Kentucky. In fact, I would tell you, Kevin, it's already been filed. I'm just waiting for the clerk to process it. And excellent. You know, now instead of dealing with one lawsuit because of what the games they played yesterday, the governor's office is gonna be dealing with two lawsuits, which is fine.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I'm up against a hard break here at the bottom of the hour, and I cannot thank you enough for all the stuff that you've done. I know that you've been involved in some other cases against some non-governmental entities and taking up the good fight on the part of citizens and standing up for the rights of citizens against these, against these governmental agencies or quasi-governmental agencies, as well as now against this dictator that we have in the state house down there. And I can't thank you enough. On behalf of the citizens or the people that I know of. And I know a lot of people appreciate what it is you're doing. And, I can only say, keep up the good fight. And interestingly enough, we keep talking about, governors and people in charge picking winners and losers. I guess now they're picking and choosing who can be a family member. Anyway. Chris, thank you so much, and appreciate you spending some time with us. And depending upon developments between now and the end of the week, maybe we'll bring people up to speed on what else is going on. So absolutely. We'll be in touch.
And I do want to add, I think we're going to get a decision on the school closures either Wednesday or Friday from the court in Frankfort. And as I said, there's another lawsuit that we just brought in federal court in Covington. We could get a decision there very quickly as well.
Excellent. Thank you for all you do, Chris. I certainly appreciate it. Chris Wiest. A constitutional law attorney, and just talk about a guy that stands up for the little guy in front of, again, years ago, they used to applaud people that spoke truth to power until now they're in power and now you're picking on them. 729, real late for a break, but 729, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Coming up on 7:34, I guess I should have cleared this with Austin beforehand. I guess kind of get behind the scenes search here, behind the scenes insight into the show here. We're supposed to take a break at 7:35. Should I take that break so we get back on schedule? And then, okay. All right. So we'll set the stage for I'll go a couple minutes here, and then we'll take a quick break and then come back and get back on schedule. I want to go through some headlines with you that I'm seeing from around the country. And this whole nonsense that there is no path to victory, that despite the things that Rob Portman and some of the spineless Republicans are saying. And as you may recall, and I would encourage you to maybe go back and listen to the podcast from the 6 o'clock hour if you didn't have a chance to listen in, there are many parallels between the 1960 election and today. Voter fraud, vote changes, people voting, more people voting in precincts than actually were registered to vote. In one instance, back in 1960, there was they said that 86 some people voted, but over 170, almost twice as number of votes were actually tallied. So, how that happens, I don't know. I don't think votes procreate overnight. I may be wrong there. But what we're seeing around the country, I'm seeing fascinating analysis and a headline, Trump campaign has a very real chance to overturn the Georgia results. Legal strategy is coming into focus. How Pennsylvania was stolen. There are almost too many stories and too many things to look at, as far as where you could see actually votes flipped, votes switched. I talked about yesterday how when we saw the governor's race last year, that where they were showing on the screen, Governor Bevin ahead, and then all of a sudden it was almost like they had cut the recording, like you see in a podcast sometimes where somebody ends a thought and then they, pause it and then come back. And so there's like a jump in the tape or a jump in the recording. There was this jump and all of a sudden the votes had switched to Beshear versus Bevin. Now, of course, technical glitches, mind you. And we saw that on election night. I mean, I can still remember listening to these pundits talking about how the odds makers had flipped from Biden winning to Trump winning. I remember Bill Hemmer going to some of these areas and saying, you know, they're saying that there's votes yet to be had out of these areas. But if you look at the total number of votes that have been counted so far versus the number of votes that were there 4 years ago, we don't think there's that much of an increase. I don't think there's enough votes here to overturn what we're seeing, et cetera. So anyway, we need to take a quick break here, get back on track. And when we come back, I want to go through the smell test of this election and why I think it just doesn't pass the smell test. 7:37 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. It is 7:40, coming up on 7:42 in the morning. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Let me give you the phone numbers, 749-5500, 1-800-823-TALK, 1-800-823-8255, if you'd like to jump on board and have a couple of comments and whatever. When I say the smell test just doesn't, for me, pass with this election. As I keep saying, I am a recovering accountant. Numbers mean something to me. When you look at statistics, when you look at numbers, they speak volumes. When I look at an election in 1964 where 70 million people voted and they were able to finish that election and finish that counting overnight, we talked about in the 6 o'clock hour with the 1960 election. They kept counting. They kept tallying votes. They kept doing everything until about 9, 10 o'clock the following morning, almost 13, 14 hours after the polls closed. And for these people, this year at 10:30, four key states suddenly, all of a sudden, in a coordinated effort, stopped vote counting because it looked like Trump was going to win. That is suspicious as hell, and I don't know why. Well, other than the fact that the spoon-fed regurgitators in the mainstream media, who are the propaganda arm of the DNC, they already have their talking points given out to them. In preparation for this, I spoke to the county clerks in Boone County and Campbell County, respectively, and asked them, because, you know, my familiarity with balloting is what I have experienced in my county. And in my county, we have the ballots that we are presented. You show up, you give them your ID, they hand you the ballot, you go over to a table, you fill in the box, they tell you to make sure you fill in the box completely, kind of like an oversight. Well, I mean, the box is pretty good size, but they tell you to, you know, make sure that that's filled in. You know, anybody that's ever filled out a lottery ticket, you know it's important to fill in the box. So anyway, we have this situation where we fill in the box and put the vote into the tabulation machine, which, by the way, aren't hooked up to a server, aren't hooked up online to where anything can be hacked. They explained to me the testing procedures of these machines and this type of thing. So anyway, I want to take this phone call real quick, and I will get to this topic about electioneering in Kentucky and why some of these things that we're seeing around the country is very suspicious as far as why would they do this? Why would they have software programs when, in fact, all it is a matter of counting? Let's get to the phones. Tim, 55 KRC, you talk about the parallels between 1960 and 2020. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you, Kevin. I really appreciate you being on. You know, I think what this points out as a conservative, I guess I want to call myself a Republican, the difference between Democrats and Republicans, I think we're seeing it again with the exception of President Trump. That's why I love him so much. The Democrats are just better at this. They will fight to the end. They will never, ever give an inch. Mm-hmm. They will back their candidate to the ends of the earth. And Republicans seem to think at some point they're supposed to take the high road or be a Rob Portman squishy rhino.
Yeah.
It's very disappointing. You know, people out there, if you wonder why we lose elections as Republicans, it's because the Democrats are better at it. They're better at campaigning.
No, they're better at stealing. Game. I don't know
and
if they're better at campaigning.
They're better at fighting.
Yeah. And even when the evidence is overwhelmingly that they've done something wrong, they just hang in there. They say, you know, we'll wait till the storm blows over because they know that the spoon-fed regurgitators in the mainstream media are on their side and they will kill the story later on and it'll just go away.
Yeah, absolutely. Trump had to be Biden, the Democrats, the media. He had to beat people in his own party.
Absolutely.
It's, really sad. It's amazing he's ever gotten elected or gotten anything done.
Absolutely. Tim, thank you very much. Thanks, I certainly Kevin. Appreciate it. Got to take a quick break here, and when we come back, I do want to finish my thought on, you know, talking to these various clerks and how it is mind-boggling that you would have any type of a system other than a tabulation and collect the counts and then report the counts. Why would you have the votes counted someplace else other than in your precinct? 7:46 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. 7:50 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Anyway, I spoke with our county clerk in Campbell County and then the county clerk over in Boone County. County clerk in Campbell County, Jim Lorison, spent some time with me talking about the election, how they put it together, and at least in Campbell County, it seemed to go flawless. Same thing over in Boone County with Justin Kriegler over there. Helpful in telling me or talking to me about what the process. All right, we have vote tabulating machines in Campbell County. You basically fill out your ballot, put it in there, it counts it. They, you know, calibrate the machines ahead of time. They make sure that they're tested. They make sure they run some sample ballots through there, make sure that they have an accurate count, roll it back to zero, and then begin on election day. You know, at the end of the day, they look at the number of people that came in, presented their ID, how many ballots they issued. They look at how many votes there are in the machine. So if there's 1,200 people that show up at a precinct to vote, that they don't have 1,400 ballots to count, or that the registered or that the machine registered 1,400 or registered only 800, et cetera. They test it as far as, well, if you don't fill in the box, if you just kind of put an X through it or whatever, they account for that. And in some cases, the machine will actually pick that up. So they go back through and review it. So when you have a vote tabulating machine, there is no, as a matter of fact, we have a very famous quote, and if I could get Austin to pull this up. Back in 2016, Obama, when Trump was talking about voter fraud and manipulation, President Obama had this to say.
The larger point that I want to emphasize here is that there is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that You could even rig America's elections, in part because they're so decentralized and the numbers of votes involved. There's no evidence that that has happened in the past or that...
Which is a lie.
There are instances in which that will happen this time.
Now, what he's referring to is that the state legislators set the rules and regulations, and where you have individual vote tabulating machines, if you've got 69 precincts like we do in Campbell County, you would have to go around and manipulate 69 different machines. Then when you count the number of precincts throughout Kentucky. But where you have a centralized system of where these machines are hooked up to a server and it's online, like in Jefferson County, like in some of the precincts and some of the states, like Pennsylvania, Michigan, some of the states that are in question, where there is software involved and somebody can come in and hack into those computers. Of course, there's a possibility of fraud. There is a possibility of manipulation. Hell, if Citibank, if Sears, well, Sears is not a very good example, but if Home Depot, any of these companies can have their systems hacked, if they can get into and hack your credit card and start stealing money from your account, do you honest to God believe that somebody can't hack into these machines and flip votes? And the only reason that you would have such a system in a state is if you are planning to cheat, if you are planning to have vote fraud, if you are planning on flipping votes from one candidate to another. Why else would you have anything other than a vote tabulating machine? We're talking about back in 1960. In 1964, 70 million votes basically counted by hand. We had 85 million votes in 1980, 104 million votes in 1992. But where you get into a situation like in Chicago in 1960, where you can actually cheat, and when you can actually get dead people to vote, when you can actually have fraudulent ballots filled out, that's where the problem comes in. It is 7:55 in the morning. Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to be talking to Covington Mayor Joe Meyer about the Brent Spence Bridge and some of the problems that Covington is seeing as a result of the diversion. It is 7:55. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It's after 8 o'clock. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. We are reaching out and trying to connect with Covington Mayor Joe Meyer, talk about the Brent Spence Bridge, the repairs that are necessary on there, and some of the things that this has called into question and some of the issues that has been raised as a result of the accident that occurred there a couple of weeks ago on a Wednesday. But as kind of some background on the Brent Spence Bridge, and when we start talking about transportation, we start talking about the interstate highway system, you know, people forget that the original highway system was established in 1956, National Interstate and Defense Highways Act. The original intent back in 1956 when Dwight Eisenhower was president was his experience as an Army officer trying to get troops from one part of the country, from the East Coast to the West Coast. And then when he realized during World War II how the Germans were able to move troops over the Autobahn, he said, you know, we need a system like that in the United States if we need troops from these. Because at the time, it took something like 3.5 to 4 weeks from troops to get from the East Coast to the West Coast. So the whole concept of the interstate commerce or the interstate highway system was defense related, but also for the betterment of and movement of people, which led to the boom in the auto industry, people being able to have freedom, traveling, being able to go from place to place in a short period of time. Again, we're still trying to reach, I believe he's calling in right now. But anyway, so one of the things that is called into question here is the fact that, you know, we keep bringing up, and in a working group that I've been part of as far as Brent Spence Bridge and pushing no tolls, is the fact that we've got three major highways, I-75, I-71, I-74, coming across one bridge. How stupid is that? Anyway, we've been able to reach out and get in touch with Joe. Joe, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I certainly appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let me give people a little bit of background that may not be familiar with you, although you've been a fixture in Northern Kentucky for, I shouldn't say a number of years, that ages you. But anyway, 15 years in the Kentucky General Assembly, both in the House and the Senate, retired in 2013 as Secretary of Education, Workforce Development Cabinet. And then just couldn't stay out of retirement and became mayor of Covington, where you are doing an absolute bang-up job over there with economic development. And, of course, been a very stalwart opponent of tolls on the Brent Spence Bridge. Bring us up to speed on just exactly what happened as far as the accident on the I-75 on Brent Spence Bridge, and what we're seeing in Kentucky or in Covington as a result of that and the diversion.
Well, I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with the fact that it was three trucks that crashed on the bridge and had an incredible fire that damaged the structural supports for the upper deck that are causing all these repairs to be done, both the structural steel as well as the pavement. And so the entire interstate, both northbound and southbound, has been closed down and will be closed down for a few more weeks. One of the effects of that, of course, has been to drive the interstate traffic through the rest of the transportation network in northern Kentucky. Secretary Jim Gray, he's Secretary of Transportation in Kentucky, has ordered that all through trucks use I-275 to go around, and that's helped a bit. But unfortunately, a lot of the through trucks continue to try to find ways to avoid using I-275, with the result that they're using these older state routes, these two-lane highways, our city streets, and creating a true gridlock on the city streets that's resulted in a lot of frustration in our residential communities and a lot of despair for our businesses. Because the businesses in places like the Mainstrasse, who are already having to deal with the coronavirus, now have to deal with such incredibly heavy traffic that people have quit patronizing the businesses because the traffic is so unpleasant.
You said to me the other day that at 6:30 at night, the place was a ghost town on a Friday night.
Yeah, it's just been... well, words almost fail to describe how empty the area is because of the traffic. And as frustrating it is, it's actually a look forward to see what life in Mainstrasse and in Covington would be like if there were to be tolls added to the Brent Spence Bridge at some point in the future.
And, of course, major construction right next to the bridge and all the disruption of the construction vehicles, the lane closures, the entrance ramps closed, and all that sort of stuff, which, again, begs the question, is our working group that we've had, the No Tolls Opposition, Northern Kentucky United, opposition to tolls in the Brent Spence Bridge and pushing more for the right sizing of the bridge and some other things that should be done. One of the things that we talked about also was, and I mentioned earlier, was this P-flip that, as a result of our group that came up with the idea, I believe it was Dick Christ or somebody who was an engineer, the Kentucky Transportation Hall of Fame, that said, hey, how about if we redesign this entrance ramp from 4th Street, close that down, have people loop around and re-enter back on 12th Street and get a better run at the bridge, and which basically opens up another lane of traffic coming across the bridge, which basically, you know, basically opens up a new lane. That kind of in a nutshell.
New lane, but it also eliminates all the weaving that takes place under the current design. Mm-hmm. You know, and with the folks get on northbound on 4th Street in Covington, if they want to go onto I-75 northbound, they have to travel over two lanes of traffic in a fairly short period of time in that really restrictive environment on the bridge,
exactly,
which contributes to a whole lot of wrecks.
Mm-hmm.
So the P-flip should not only speed up traffic, but it's projected to result in about a 30% reduction in car wrecks on the approach and on the bridge itself. So,
and again, this is something that a working group of citizens getting together and having somebody other than I guess OKI and well, we won't get into that, but independent eyes looking at this and saying, hey, you know, how about trying this? And so that's definitely a benefit as the working group that we've had. Now, again, this begs the question with these through trucks coming through. And first of all, we got to question the idea of hazardous material, hazmat coming through the center of a town. You know, there should be some sort of legislation, and I'm shocked that there isn't, that that those kinds of vehicles have to take the loop around the city. But also begs the question of, hey, maybe we should be revisiting the whole idea of the Cincy Eastern Bypass.
Well, look, the Brent-Spence Bridge is the result of a historic fundamental design flaw. You mentioned it earlier. You cannot have three interstates using one bridge, one corridor, and expect things to go well forever.
Mm-hmm.
The flaw is that when I-71 was built in Kentucky, it was allowed to go onto the I-71 corridor instead of establishing its own corridor around to the eastern side of Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. Simple fact.
Yeah, exactly.
The folks in Ohio, ODOT, has long said that with the way that Cincinnati is laid out, the more lanes that you build on I-75, the more traffic you draw, because you have the Norwood Lateral, the Cross County Highway, you have a parallel route with I-71, and they say that as long as they continue to build lanes on I-75, they will fill it because of the nature of the traffic network in the region. In other words, no matter how big you build the Brent-Spence Bridge, you're not going to be able to build your way out of this problem, which argues strenuously for an alternative route that fundamentally changes the design nature of the greater Cincinnati transportation network.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. We need to take a quick break. Can you hang with us through the break? Because when we come back, I want to really delve into, because this is more than anything else, a true indication of what diversion would be like if you tolled the Brent-Spence Bridge. Because a lot of people, no matter how low the toll is, they don't want to pay it. And they're going to take an alternative route. And the stress that you explained to me and what we've seen as far as one of the landmarks in this area of the suspension bridge, and in some of the city, in some of the roads where the trucks are too big to fit on that, and how they've had to turn around, which is, when you explained that to me, was an absolute nightmare. So,
yes,
so when we get back, we'll cover that territory as well. My guest, Joe Meyer, he is the mayor of Covington and doing an absolute fantastic job for that city. I am Kevin Gordon, filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Eight 19 in the morning. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Continuing our conversation with Covington Mayor Joe Meyer, has been a long service of service to Kentucky, and I am glad that I've gotten to know him over the years, and he is doing an absolutely fantastic job for the city of Covington. Again, thanks for joining us this morning, Joe. I certainly appreciate it. We left off with, you know, talking about diversion and a taste of what we would experience as far as Brent-Spence Bridge construction, diversion if there are tolls on the Brent-Spence Bridge. Some of the nightmare scenarios that you have seen over just when the bridge was closed, what we're seeing, what happened, or what was happening to the landmark of the area, the suspension bridge, and then some traffic where we think that people with GPS, that they are paying attention to signs, that they are reading signs and can follow directions as to what height restrictions and what weight limits there are, that apparently sometimes when, you know, you're in a hurry and you're so selfish that you want to deliver goods, you just completely ignore that at the expense of a city and traffic.
Well, yeah, Kevin, the big shocker was on the first night that the bridge was shut down, and that has to do with truck traffic on the Roebling Suspension Bridge. You know, that bridge is under a severe weight limit, only 11 tons or 22,000 pounds, and there is a risk of a severe damage to that bridge with a lot of the truck traffic or heavy weights on it. And the very first night, despite the signage, despite the warnings, trucks were using the bridge so heavily that, at one point there were four trucks nose to tail crossing that bridge. In other words, over 300,000 pounds on a bridge with a 22,000-pound weight limit. We were very, very concerned about the overall safety of that bridge. Quite honestly, we were wonderfully surprised that more structural damage had not occurred. We had to take some fairly aggressive steps to stop the trucks completely, and that was by shutting down the bridge to all traffic. We could not get the trucks alone to discontinue use of the bridge, and we didn't have sufficient enforcement resources to do anything except shut down the whole bridge. It's a reminder of how interconnected our transportation network is, which really takes us into a bigger point, and that is the total cost of the Brent Spence Bridge Corridor project. You know, OKI and the others are tossing out this $2.6 billion number, but they're not picking up any of the other costs that are associated with it. And like the diversion that we've experienced now shows, that you've got to build in the cost of upgrading the infrastructure on I-275, I-471, the city streets in Covington and Newport, the Roebling Suspension Bridge, the I-471 bridge, because if you toll it, their own studies show 77,000 cars a day are going to be traveling all of these other networks. So when you add those costs in to the cost of the corridor itself, all of a sudden that eastern bypass, that outer loop, seems much more attractive and financially doable.
Mm-hmm. And I've pointed out in the past that the studies, and people keep telling me that, well, you know, the governor of Kentucky was a Republican, one of your guys, and according to them, they said it was unfeasible. And it was first of all, I think their study was flawed, and all you need to do is look at the fact that they counted trucks as the same as a passenger vehicle. And anybody that's ever driven anywhere knows that just if you put a truck there, you can have, what, maybe four or five cars lined up next to that. And then right. When you take into consideration the stopping and starting gaps between trucks and traffic flow, you take a truck off of I-75 and put that on the outer belt or on a Cincy Eastern bypass, that's basically the equivalent of taking at least 10 to 15 cars off of a highway. And then you're talking about, when you do that, you're basically increasing the traffic flow across the Brent Spence Bridge by astronomical numbers. So anyway, that's a side note.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. And the trucks, we've discovered another problem when they use the city streets. The clearances for trucks under the railroad bridges that cross many Kentucky Covington streets are inadequate for the newer trucks to get under. So we were often stuck with trucks that ignored the signs and tried to explore these other routes, who wound up coming face to face with a railroad bridge that had a 13-foot clearance or a 12.5-foot clearance, with the result being that the trucks could not go forward. They were already stuck in traffic, and now they had to back up. So we had to bring in law enforcement more than once to clear the traffic, to allow the trucks to back up, turn around, and then go on their way to find their way to the Clayway-Bailey Bridge or over the 12th Street Bridge into Newport into I-471.
What an absolute noise.
Three, four, five, six, seven times a day. Jeez. At various locations in Covington, and contributing to real concern about the residents and the drivers.
You mentioned that there were some buildings that were actually hit, some residential buildings that were hit by trucks turning around or turning corners.
Yes, more than once that happened. You know, these old city streets are just not made for the size of trucks that run up and down our interstate highways.
Yeah, you're talking about a completely different animal. And, you know, again, this is why there is a need for various people to be involved in these study groups and to actually get accurate facts. You know, when we have certain reporters...
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
Chumba.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18
plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. That are just touting the party line, if you will, that, oh, well, this study was done. Well, dig into the study and find out just actually what the numbers are, and you'll find out in a lot of instances that those are factually incorrect. But anyway, Joe, I feel your pain over there. I know that you're doing a great job over there, and it is very important that people realize that what is happening, that is just not a matter of building another bridge or freeing up traffic or any of that sort of stuff. It is a matter of looking at what the impact of that has on a city and on a corridor. And as we said from the beginning, why in the hell would you have three major interstates coming across one bridge?
Yeah. Well, Kevin, we're going to continue to fight for a sensible transportation solution that truly benefits this entire region for the long run.
Yes.
No short-term solution, a long-term 50, 100, 150-year view as to what our transportation needs are.
And, hey, how about something that adds to economic development? Gee, what a novel concept.
Well, you know, one of the great things about investing in infrastructure is the economic development that comes along with it. And if you want to see what it means, all you have to do is look back the last 50 years here in Northern Kentucky in particular, where you could see what I-75 has meant to economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
We should have that sort of opportunity for the next 50 years, and that requires that outer loop to be developed to give us the chance to continue to grow the economy of our region versus throwing billions of dollars into an already heavily developed corridor.
Absolutely. Well said. Joe, thanks so much. You guys have a great Thanksgiving, and all my best to you and your family, and best of wishes for you.
Likewise, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
All righty, Joe. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Joe Meyer, the mayor of Covington, Kentucky, somebody I'm sure glad that I got to know over the years. Just a great guy and doing a great job for the city of Covington. It is 8:28 in the morning. Phone number 749-5500, 1-800-823-TALK, 1-800-823-8255, #550, AT&T Wireless Phone. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. It's 8:32 in the morning. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. Look at some of the local headlines that we're following. And, of course, big news or tragic news for the Cincinnati Bengals and the Cincinnati area. Again, like I said, I've not been a big fan of professional football for the last couple of years. And I've been doing my best to ignore it. But I do appreciate the efforts of Joe Burrow, and I thought he would be a tremendous fit and a tremendous asset to the Cincinnati Bengals. And, of course, you know, wishing him well. But then the devastating knee injury that he suffered on Sunday, looks like a lot more damage than was originally indicated. MRI showed that Burrow tore ACL, MCL, and suffered other structural issues. Injuries of this nature take anywhere from 9 to 12 months. I wish for him all the best, and I hope he can have a speedy recovery. But in the meantime, just more bad luck for the Cincinnati Bengals when it comes to I don't know. It just seems like our quarterbacks seem to be targets around the NFL for some reason. We seem to have more quarterback injuries than just about any other team. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is seeking the suspension of Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld after the councilman was indicted on federal bribery charges. The indictment alleges violation of very laws that guard against misuse of public office and criminalized use in public office for personal gain. His filing continued. We go to the Supreme Court to seek a suspension of Cincinnati Councilman Sittenfeld. And, of course, Sittenfeld on Friday did a Twitter feed and an interview or a statement online. You know, the phrase, "you doth protest too much," seems to come to mind there. Jeff Pastor continued to claim his innocence, but he's accepted a suspension from city council. And very telling that some things that this can go on. And I've mentioned before, I'll tell you what, I'm going to pick this up. I'm going to stay on break here. But when I get back, I want to talk about Cincinnati City Council, some of the corruption, and what I think is part of the problem is because we don't have a media that follows up on things. 8:35 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. 8:39 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station. If you've been wanting to get online, if you want to challenge me on anything, I know I've got some frenemies out there that would like to bring up some topics, but go right ahead. Phone number 749-5500, 1-800-823-TALK, 1-800-823-8255, or #550 AT&T wireless phone. Before the break, I mentioned a comment about Cincinnati City Council. You know, this is going to sound harsh, but, you know, I have an opinion. I'm not afraid to use it. I lay some of the problem of the corruption in Cincinnati on our media. And I lay it on not necessarily the reporters per se, although they do share in some of the blame. I blame it on some of these news agencies, whether it's the Cincinnati Inquirer or some of the television networks. They are so interested in squeezing that bottom line that they have cut their staffs to the bone. If you recall, there was a few years ago when the Cincinnati Inquirer decided that even though they had reporters that had been working for them for 15, 16 years, they come in and they say, well, we're restructuring things and everybody is going to have to re-interview for their job. Can you imagine doing a job for 15 years or so and then somebody telling you basically that your job doesn't exist and you got to re-interview for it? Damn it, either I'm doing my job and you need to continue my employment, or if I'm not doing my job, get rid of me. Now, granted, the editorial bent of the Inquirer for the years has been going slow, rapidly downhill, more liberal. More people are frustrated with the Inquirer and have stopped their subscription and won't even read the newspaper anymore, which has led to decrease in advertising, which has led to less revenue and less ability. And because of that, their reporters are having to do more stories, cover wider areas. They've got, at one time, there was one reporter or two reporters that were covering all of the city councils in Northern Kentucky, which is a damn near impossibility. And what I've witnessed with some of these reporters is that you can really have an interesting topic that you want, that you've brought up at either a fiscal court meeting in a county or at a city council meeting, to where the people, the mayor or the judge executive, really doesn't have a good answer for what it is you've asked. Cannot justify some of the spending, cannot justify some of the tax increases. And yet at the end of the meeting, like a lapdog, the reporter runs up to the front to get a quote from the mayor or from the judge executive about, well, what do you think about what was said? And of course, they're going to deny it. They're going to say, oh, well, you know, that's just a citizen. He doesn't really know what he's talking about, et cetera, et cetera. Rather than asking the person that brought up the topic, you know, where did you get your information? What are some of the background? I have spent on a couple of topics back in 2012, 2013, almost an hour and a half talking to a particular reporter in Northern Kentucky about a non-governmental entity that was basically in violation of state law on how they were taxing the people. I went through the explanation of with him of to why we opposed certain things that this entity was doing, the money they were spending, etc. And basically, when the story was written, it was written from the perspective of this governmental agency, and the comment was, well, there are some people that have raised some issues, but according to this agency, those are unfounded. Seriously? I've presented you with numbers. I've presented you with facts. I've presented you with figures. But because they are so in tune and because they need to have sources, and since the best, well, not the best source, but the easiest source is the mayor, is the non-governmental agency that they can get a quote from, that they can get information from, they go with the easiest source. Not the accurate source. Not the correct source, but something that they can just put in the paper. And I wonder sometimes if it's an editorial decision on the part of the reporter because they are a bubble or two left of center, or if it's because their editorial staff or their editors push them to have that kind of a viewpoint. But the fact that all this corruption is going on in the city of Cincinnati, and not one reporter has been able to ferret that out or to run a story on that ahead of time. You know, if you hang around long enough, if you talk to enough people, if you're in and around a certain group of people, rumors are flying. Rumors, there is different information. There are people that call reporters and give them information. And so many times these reporters don't follow up on it. I don't know, again, if it's a matter of they don't give a damn, or if, in fact, they are spread so thin they don't have time to actually delve into it. But if you had a true media watchdog in this area, would some of this stuff actually have gone on, or would it have been ferreted out and eliminated and reported on before you have to have these many resignations? I don't know. Just my thoughts. Coming up on 8:46 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas. Phone number 749-5500, 1-800-823-TALK, 1-800-823-8255, #550, AT&T wireless phone. Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55KRC, the talk station. Yeah, it's 8:50 in the morning, Kevin Gordon filling in for Brian Thomas, 55KRC, the talk station. You know, I cannot emphasize enough that I believe that this election is attempting to be stolen by the Democrats, that there is widespread voter fraud. There is all kinds of stories out there that are pointing to that. Anybody that you know, after what I talked about in the 6 o'clock hour with the shenanigans and the voter fraud that went on in the 1960 election, 60 years later, they've perfected their techniques. We have seen indications of voter fraud. As a matter of fact, there's a story that the five most rigged elections in the history of the country. We know that Lyndon Johnson stole an election to gain his Senate seat back in the 60s. And don't think that these things haven't continued. Now, I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts today. When they're talking about that, there is no indication of voter fraud and proof. Well, how do you know unless you're going to investigate and unless you have accurate counts? Why in the hell would you have a voter machine that's hooked up to a server where the votes are counted overseas? Why would you buy a computer that was used in Venezuela to switch elections down there and to put in a Marxist dictator? If you're not trying to swing an election, if you're not trying to cheat an election, who in God's name would ever buy that kind of a computer that can be manipulated that way and have backdoor systems to where they could flip votes? Who would allow that to happen other than somebody who is corrupt and somebody who is trying to cheat? Now, when they start talking about voter turnout, when they start talking about, let's give you a quick, real quick and dirty history here, if I can run through this real quick. 1964, a year after the Kennedy assassination, to continue the Kennedy legacy, voter turnout was almost 62%. 70 million votes were cast. In 1976, Nixon had resigned in August of 1974. Carter was a new era Democrat. 80 million votes were cast. Turnout was 53%, 53.5%. 4 years later, during the Carter administration, if you recall, the disastrous Carter administration, nearly 13.5% inflation. Prime rate of, on loans was 21.5%. There were mortgages that were 23% interest. We had the Iran hostage crisis. The first time, well, you remember Reagan said, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Recession is when your neighbor loses his job. Depression is when you lose your job. And a recovery is when Jimmy Carter loses his job. In that election in 1980, 52% turnout, 85 million votes were cast. 1992, Bill Clinton, you recall the comeback kid, first baby boom president? Turnout was 55%. Go to 2008, the first black president, the Messiah, Nobel Prize winning Barack Obama. Remember all the crowds? Remember the people fainting, standing there for hours, and how wonderful this was? Obama, 58% voter turnout, 129.5 million votes. 2016, turnout was 55.7%. When I looked at these statistics, I questioned whether or not there was some voters or some votes switched or vote suppression. I find it hard to believe that from 2008 to 2016, that 500,000 less people voted in the 2016 election than voted in 2008. 29 million votes were cast. In 2020, they are telling us that 25 million more people voted in 2020 than in 2016. Do they really expect us to believe that Biden received 10 million more votes than Obama? That he, the first black president. That he received 14 million more votes than Hillary? Just the idea that a woman on the ticket. This election does not pass the smell test. I'll leave you with that. Tomorrow morning, join us. I've got on the agenda, Kurt Hartman will be talking about a lawsuit that he's filed to remove Jeff Pastor and another lawsuit to remove P.G. Sittenfeld. And at 8 o'clock, we're going to be talking to Congressman Massey. Kevin Gordon, filling in for Brian Thomas. Thank you very much for being with us today, and I appreciate all my guests. Kevin Gordon, filling in for Brian Thomas, 55 KRC, the talk station.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.